And it is 12 noon. You're listening to KPFA Berkeley, KPFB Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. Tomorrow, Tuesday, June 26, KPFA will take down the audio of its programming on kpfa.org for 24 hours as part of an Internet Day of Silence. The action will be taken to protest a decision by the Copyright Royalty Board due to go into effect on July 15th, which would hike the fees that webcasters pay in royalties and which could severely curtail KPFA's ability to provide its programming on the web. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, June 26th. For more information, go to kpfa.org. Stay tuned for Against the Grain.
Against the Grain, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez once spoke of a third way between capitalism and socialism. Now Chavez speaks of building a new type of socialism, a humanist one. Among those encouraged by this is Michael Leibowitz. I'm C.S. Song. I'll talk with the author of Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century, after these news headlines with Mark Maracle.
The Supreme Court tightened limits on student speech today, ruling against a high school student and his 14-foot-long Bong Hits for Jesus banner. Schools may prohibit student expression that can be interpreted as advocating drug use, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the court in a 5-4 ruling. Joseph Friedrich unfurled his homemade sign in 2002 as the Olympic torch made its way through Juneau, Alaska, en route to the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. Friedrich said the banner was a nonsensical message that he first saw on a snowboard. He intended the banner to proclaim his right to say anything at all. His principal, Deborah Morse, said the phrase was a pro-drug message that had no place at a school-sanctioned event. Friedrich denied that he was advocating drug use. The message on Friedrich's banner is cryptic, Roberts said, but Principal Morse thought the banner would be interpreted by those viewing it as promoting illegal drug use, and that interpretation is plainly a reasonable one, Judge Roberts said. A Supreme Court victory for developers over environmentalists. The court is siding with the developers and the Bush administration in a case involving the protection of endangered species. At issue was the intersection of two environmental laws, the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. The court said, when the federal government lets a state issue water pollution permits, the Clean Water Law should be considered ahead of the Endangered Species Act. A federal appeals court had said the Environmental Protection Agency wasn't doing enough to make sure endangered species wouldn't be harmed when the states took over the permit process. The Supreme Court ruled today that ordinary taxpayers cannot challenge a White House initiative that helps religious charities get a share of federal money. The 5-4 decision blocks a lawsuit by a group of atheists and agnostics against 8 Bush administration officials, including the head of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. The taxpayers group, the Freedom From Religion Foundation Incorporated, objected to government conferences in which administration officials encourage religious charities to apply for federal grants. A suicide bomber apparently targeting a meeting of U.S. allied Sunni sheikhs penetrated layers of security and blew himself up in a hotel lobby today, killing 4 tribal leaders and at least 8 others. The sheikhs were associated with the Anbar Salvation Council, which has taken up arms to help drive fighters of al-Qaeda in Iraq from the western province of Anbar. The attack was among 5 suicide and other bombings today that killed at least 45 people across Iraq. The U.S. command also reported a U.S. soldier shot to death in South Baghdad. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said today he intends to free 250 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails in a goodwill gesture to President Mahmoud Abbas. The two leaders held talks in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh, their first meeting since Islamist Hamas routed Abbas's secular forces in Gaza this month to split the enclave from his larger stronghold in the West Bank. Hamas has accused Abbas of giving in to Zionist blackmail. And the state of California has declared a state of emergency in the area near Lake Tahoe, where firefighters are battling a raging forest fire. News returns here on KPFA at 3:30 with Free Speech Radio News. News headlines again at 4. Please join us at 6 for the hour-long edition of the KPFA News. Now stay tuned for Against the Grain.
You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Hugo Chavez, the leftist leader of Venezuela and one of George W. Bush's main antagonists, wishes to reinvent socialism. In a speech at the 2005 World Social Forum, Chavez declared, quote, "We have to reinvent socialism. It can't be the kind of socialism that we saw in the Soviet Union, but it will emerge as we develop new systems that are built on cooperation, not competition," unquote. What does President Chavez mean by this? What is socialism anyway? And to what extent is the system that Chavez has put in place, to what extent does that constitute a socialist system, a system rooted in solidarity, social responsibility, and worker self-management? These are some of the questions that occupy the mind of Michael Leibowitz. Michael is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada, and he is author most recently of Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century. Michael Leibowitz lives most of the year in Caracas, Venezuela, but he joins us by phone today from his home, his second home in Vancouver. Welcome to you.
Hi, C.S. How are you?
Hi, Michael. Before we talk about a new socialism, let's make sure we understand the more traditional conception. What did the 19th century thinker Karl Marx have in mind when he talked about socialism?
Well, Marx, when he talked about socialism, did not have in mind much different perspective than most people who spoke about socialism, or at least the goal of socialism. And that goal was repeatedly seen as the full development of human beings, the full development of all their potential, all their capacities, etc. And Marx, you know, shared that general perspective. Where he differed from other people who advocated socialism in the 19th century was how to get there and how to create that new society which unleashed, you know, human potential.
Why didn't Karl Marx see capitalism as leading to or helping in the development of human potential and capacities? What was it about capitalism that he thought was inimical to human needs?
Well, to begin with, the whole perspective of Marx was to identify the particular characteristics of capitalism, by which he meant the situation in which those who own the means of production are oriented solely toward the development of their profits, solely toward the growth of their capital,
Means of production are like factories, tools. Tell us about that a little.
Means of production are tools, factories, raw materials, everything except the human component in the process of production. And those people who own that, Marx argued, have the sole goal of profits. So for them, everything is a means. Human beings are a means. Nature is a means. The sole goal is the growth of profits. Now, characteristic of capitalism, though, and uniquely characteristic of capitalism, was that the mass of people had no way of surviving, without selling their ability to work to the capitalist. And so, because they sold their ability to work to the capitalist, because they could not, function any other way, they were immediately placed under the control and direction of the capitalist to perform activities which met the capitalist goals, which are the growth of profits. So the whole process of work is a process in which you are directed from above, directed from above to follow you know, the goals, which are the goals of capital. And Marx argued, you know, that one of the characteristics of this process as capitalism developed was the complete separation of the process of thinking and the process of producing. That this was inherent in the system to begin with, that whole process in which the goals of production are the goals of capital. But it became separated technically as well, in which, you know, workers simply go to work, that, you know, the thinking process is not really part of their work. This was something that Henry Ford, you know, and Frederick Winslow Taylor in the U.S., you know, very clear on, you know, your job is not to think, your job is to follow orders. And that characterized the production process of capitalism. So how could then this be a situation in which human beings could develop their potential? And Marx certainly saw that this was, you know, completely, you know, antithetical to the development of what he saw as this goal, the rich human being. And he talks about that quite a bit, both in his early writings and later in his writings in the 1850s in his notebooks called The Grundrisse, the concept of the rich human being who is all-sided in capacities, all-sided in needs, etc., fully developing their human capacity.
So if workers, Michael, are exploited by the capitalist class under capitalism, if profits are the main raison d'etre of enterprises under capitalism, if people do more than they think under capitalism, what did Marx and his successors think workers needed to be able to do? How did they need to develop? In what ways did they need to perhaps evolve such that exploitation would end and profits would no longer be the primary motivator of society?
Well, one thing that Marx observed, you know, was in the middle of the 19th century was the development of cooperatives, where workers organized production themselves, selected their own managers, etc. And he saw that as very desirable, but he was very clear on the fact that establishing cooperatives, which he saw would be dwarfish, you know, small little, you know, processes, could not possibly overturn capitalism. And anyone who has the illusions that by creating little islands of cooperation in which people can develop differently will put an end to the system is completely deluded, Marx said. And he argued, you know, that what was necessary for this process to change was for all the means of production to be transferred to society. That could be then the basis of creating a new form of production without exploitation, which allowed for the development of human beings. And for that process, one of the central aspects of it is something that Marx and Engels wrote about in the Communist Manifesto, is you have to use the state. The state is necessary in order to step by step, by degrees, make this process of transferring capital away from the capitalist class, away from the bourgeoisie, and making it available to establish new productive relations in which workers are dominant.
Michael Leibowitz is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Simon Fraser University. He's author of Beyond Capital, Marx's Political Economy of the Working Class. He lives most of the year in Venezuela, where he runs an institute that brings in international exports to support the social justice agenda in Venezuela. And he's author most recently of a book published by Monthly Review Press entitled Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century. He joins us today by phone from Vancouver, Canada. At one point in your book, you write that socialism is not populism. What do you mean by that?
Well, populism is certainly a term that is very familiarly used in Latin America. It's identified with, you know, various leaders who were seen as populist, who provided many things from above, social services, increased wages, etc. But, you know, the characteristic of populism that I wanted to stress was that this remains a process from above. And socialism, in contrast, has to be a process in which people are able to transform themselves through their own activity. So populism does not change people. Creating socialist institutions does create the potential for creating socialist human beings.
You argue in this book that you can't really talk about a new socialism without talking about Venezuela, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. And before we talk about what Hugo Chavez has been doing, has been trying to do in that nation, let's go back a little bit and talk about oil wealth in Venezuela and what impact the oil resources and the oil royalties and oil profits had on who held power in that nation before Chavez and who benefited from that power.
Well, it's impossible to talk about Venezuela without talking about oil, not simply because right now it gets significant oil revenues, but because the existence of the oil industry and the ability to export oil has shaped the entire society. It's done that in terms of what, you know, some people often refer to the phenomenon called the Dutch disease, that by having a lucrative export product such as oil, you export this oil, your exchange rates are affected by your high exports, and therefore it becomes easy to import very cheaply. And so what tends to occur under those circumstances, all other things equal, is that your local manufacturing tends to disappear and local agriculture tends to disappear. Well, that certainly, was characteristic of the Venezuelan process. There was a lot of effort in the earlier oil booms to develop local industry, and local industry emerged in the context of a prospering economy. But with the effect of the oil revenues and the oil exports was that the local industry could not sustain itself because it was so much easier to import the things that were needed. The same thing happened in terms of agriculture, people working in the countryside found that they could not, sell at prices that could match what could be imported. Now, those kinds of changes in Venezuela, which involved a very substantial movement from the rural areas to the cities, to living on the outskirts, the hills outside the cities, and Venezuela is one of the most urbanized countries around, certainly in Latin America, perhaps Uruguay might be as urbanized, what that did was mean that you had a situation in which there was very little, domestic production. So you have effectively a hollowed out economy as a result of oil. And oil itself doesn't generate much employment. It's a highly, machine, and technique intensive process of production rather than one that creates a lot of employment. So that's at the level of the economy. But I would say the more important aspect of the characteristics of the Venezuela's oil, the effect of Venezuela's oil, is the cultural effect, because what became the absolutely critical question was to get access to the oil rents, find ways to access to the oil rents. And one of the best books on this subject is a book by Fernando Coronil, a Venezuelan who teaches at the University of Michigan, called The Magical State, which is this idea that the state suddenly is really the place where that oil revenue can be somehow reached. And so what you have is this process of clientelism emerges, in which there are mechanisms of how do you, rise in such a way as to get some access to, the oil rents. And that clientelism is closely associated with corruption, because the whole culture of Venezuela became a culture dominated by corruption. And so there, you'd find sayings like, I'd hear people say when I first went there, well, Venezuela, we're a country in which we give prizes for who could steal the most from the state. Mm. Or somebody saying, look, just show us a saying, which was, just show us where the money is. In other words, don't give us any money. Real men can steal for themselves. So it's that kind of culture that you have there. And that culture doesn't disappear overnight. It infects, the Chavez project, too. Clientelism and corruption are two of the most central problems they have to deal with now.
Michael Liebowitz joins us today on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Associate producer Jen Angel is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song, and Michael Liebowitz he lives most of the year in Caracas, Venezuela. He is the author most recently of Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Several of the book's chapters have been published independently as small booklets, some of which have been referred to and recommended by none other than the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, who, Michael, was elected president in 1998. He called, among other things, then for a constituent assembly to rewrite the constitution of that nation. And the new constitution of Venezuela was in place by the following year, by 1999. To what extent was that constitution, on the one hand, anti-capitalist, and on the other, socialist?
Well, first of all, let me just say that, you know, you can't sort of drop Chavez from the sky. I mean, Chavez is a military person who was, you know, very unhappy about what was happening in Venezuela in the 1980s when it was dominated by neoliberalism, when it was, you know, subjected to the Washington consensus of, you know, cut, you know, social expenditures, you know, move, open up the, you know, everything for foreign capital, etc. His group became extremely, you know, within the army, and it was an underground group, became extremely concerned when there was a people's revolt against the neoliberal measures, some of the neoliberal measures in 1989. This is the Caracazo, and in which the army was basically called upon to put this revolt down, and thousands of people were killed. He happily was away from that situation. But it's in that context, that revolt in 1989, that he then worked with left groups, civil groups, to plan the revolt of 1992, in which he, you know, began to create this situation of, to overturn the existing constitution, overturn this absolute corruption that had existed, in which two parties, you know, democratically controlled the society and took turns, you know, in ruling the government, but nothing changed for people. And Chavez's, revolt in 1992 was not successful, but Chavez became a national figure when he asked for a few minutes on television to call it off when it was clear it was not going to be successful. And he said at that point, "We have not succeeded on television. We have not succeeded in our goals. But we will continue in our struggles." And then he went to prison. Well, that idea that he took responsibility for this, which was unheard of, and two is he said, you know, "For now we have not succeeded," made him a figure very popular throughout the country. And in prison, there he was. What did he do? He studied. He read. He worked on his master's. And he was, you know, reading Negri. And he wrote from prison this text in which he talked about, you know, you have to get rid of this kind of government, a government which does nothing about poverty, etc. We have to create a situation in which the people are not simply the objects of power, but the subjects of power. For revolutionaries, there is no alternative. Now, through the 90s, Chavez attracted all people who were, you know, anxious to change the system. And so when he is elected in 1998, on the theme of changing the Constitution, he then calls immediately for this constituent assembly, and elected to the constituent assembly are all these people from the social movements that were struggling. So the Constitution is that they begin to write is an extraordinary document, excellent in its work on indigenous people, because the indigenous people were very well represented. Respect for languages, for land, for culture, etc., all in the Constitution. Excellent on questions of the women's, you know, issues, because, you know, are just purely women's issues, movements in this, constituent assembly also put into this process, into this constitution, some very fascinating elements by saying, the goal is the full development of human beings, that everything that, must be, create the potential of people developing all their creative potential in all respects. So the concept of human development permeates this constitution. So also is a very unique aspect, which is the concept of how you get that, human development. And this was something that when I saw immediately thought, this is Marx. Because what it said is that people develop, their human potential, their full capacities only through participation, only through protagonism. And that became, a theme that it's only through participation, protagonism, that people develop their full capacities, individual and collective. So that was an element in the Constitution, which is very dramatic, and I think I would say that element is the seeds of a socialist economy, a socialist society. But it wasn't the only element, in the Constitution, because the Constitution drew from the old constitutions, and it also drew from the fact that the Constituent Assembly was a collection of many people. So the Constitution, continues to talk about the state fostering and supporting private initiative. It talks about the central bank having autonomy and independence, a characteristic demand of neoliberalism. And it basically contains within it many elements that are quite consistent with capitalism. So you have these two aspects, this focus on human development on the one hand, and the continued support for capitalism. I consider the first as, in fact, the subversive element within the process, but it reflected Chavez's perspective at the time. At the time, Chavez was thinking third way. He was talking to Tony Blair. He was saying, we can create a humane capitalism, a capitalism which is not like neoliberalism. In other words, a clear rejection of neoliberalism, but not a rejection of capitalism as such. And you can see that reflected in the first, economic plan that is set out, for 2001 to 2007. It talks about, there'll be a state sector, the important state sectors, such as obviously oil, but there will also be, an emphasis on the private sector, and the goal is to create trust on the part of, both domestic and foreign investors. And then there'll be a social economy, which will be, support for, self-managed, self-operated activity, cooperatives and the like, which will support through Grameen-type banks, microcredit, a women's development bank, et cetera. So you have initially all these differing elements, not necessarily compatible, but reflecting, being more or less a photograph of the various forces that existed at that time.
In the arena of the social economy, which you just mentioned, which, supplements and certainly interacts with the private sector and the public sector in Venezuela, in relation to the social economy, you have something called co-management, and that is illustrated by what happened to, among other firms, a private firm named Venipal. What is co-management?
Well, that is, co-management has a lot of meanings. It depends on what country you're talking about. Co-management, for example, in Germany, became effectively a mechanism of co-opting the trade unions and the workers into the capitalist goals in the German corporations. In Venezuela, the way co-management has effectively been interpreted is as worker management. So when they use the term co-management, it's largely worker management. The concept of a co there is a a cooperation in between workers and the state. So co-management has primarily been talked about as a process within the state sector in which workers have, you know, increasing power in decision making. And in variance, because there are, even in Venezuela, there are many variations of co-management. In some cases, it takes the form of electing directors. In some cases, it takes the form of shares of stock. In the particular case of Venepal, or is now Invepal, what had happened was a classic case of a company suffering through the 90s, which was a bleak period, you know, in Venezuela. It was a papermaking firm. And they had great difficulties in maintaining themselves, so they went bankrupt. They closed the operations. Workers occupied it. This is after, you know, Chavez was elected. Workers occupied Venepal because they were certain that what Venepal was going to do was basically strip the company of its assets, take the machinery, some of which was quite modern, and ship it out and leave just the shell. So there was a struggle happening between the trade unions and the people who organized this occupation and the company. And the workers were calling for Venepal to be taken over. The response of the government was not to, initial response was not to take over Venepal. The Constitution as it exists, and there are major constitutional changes being explored at this very point, but the Constitution as it exists allows for, you know, a company to be taken over if it's clearly in the public interest. Well, it wasn't entirely clear that a relatively small, you know, paper manufacturing company was in the public interest to take over. But what happened in this situation was, so the government, you know, provided very, you know, substantial credit to get, you know, Venepal operating again. And Venepal opened up its activities and began producing again, not as high at high a level as it had before, but nevertheless producing and, you know, brought back many of the workers, but not all of them because it wasn't as large. And then it shut down again. And so, again, the workers occupied it, didn't, you know, want machinery to be shipped out. And so what ultimately happened under those circumstances was that the government agreed to take over Venepal, renamed it Invepal, and then developed a particular mechanism in which the workers who had occupied it would become a cooperative. And this cooperative would have 49% of the shares of the company, and the state would hold 51% of the shares, but it would not, it would allow the operation to be run by the workers. So there was a version of this process. And what was interesting is from the perspective of the state, I mean, it was a clear advance. Chavez, when Invepal was created, said, workers, go down and do likewise. You know, if you have this kind of situation, you take it over. The Minister of Labor, about 6 months later, was asked, you know, why aren't you taking over these companies? You know, there were all these shutdown companies. And she said, and she's one of the, this is Maria Cristina Iglesias, who's one of the real thinkers of this government. She said, you don't have to ask our permission to take over. So there was that kind of initiative. But the Invepal story is a sad one for several reasons. For one, the problem of cooperatives. What is the goal of a cooperative? It's often maximize the income of the workers, of a particular small group of workers. Well, that's, you know, I was at a conference, Solidarity Conference in 2005, and, you know, gave a talk on lessons of Yugoslavia. And at that same, you know, conference, one of the representatives from Invepal spoke, and he said, you know, we've got 49% of the shares. We want 99%, and we can do that. And everyone should have a cooperative. You know why? Because cooperatives don't have to pay taxes. Well, I mean, there was self-interest right in your face. No concern about the society as a whole. And that is, was one of the characteristics, you know, that occurred in Yugoslavia as well. But there was this other aspect to it too. And this became a major, the source of a major upheaval at Invapol. Well, the Invapol had all these workers that had been previously employed by Venipol, the private firm. And these workers, the cooperative was just the workers who had occupied, but there were all these other workers who had, maybe occupied initially, but then went off and got a job, in order to maintain their families, et cetera. Invapol hired these other workers, and it hired them as wage laborers, which cooperatives can do. And it, but under the cooperative law that was created under Chavez, you can only be an employee of a cooperative for 6 months, and then you have to be brought into the cooperative. So the idea of being exploited over a period of time, infinitely is precluded. So that's what was happening with Invapol. It had a number of its old comrades, its old workmates, now working as wage laborers while the Invapol group was working as, was the cooperative with 49% of the shares and presumably the profits. Well, what happened was they fired them before 6 months. They didn't want more people in the cooperative as such. And that is, again, one of the problems of a focus on cooperatives because they can create solidarity within, but the question of their solidarity in relationship to the rest of society, to other groups of workers with whom they may be competing, is another question entirely. From my studies of Yugoslavia, and I studied that for a number of years, this was such a familiar pattern for me.
Right, and you're referring to the system of socialist self-management pushed by Tito in Yugoslavia in the 1950s and beyond, and it was considered or once seen as a success story, as a successful third way between Soviet bloc-style socialism and the capitalist West. I'm CS. He is Michael Leibowitz. We're talking about his most recent book, Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century. We'll take a short music break. I want to ask him more about Yugoslavia. I want to ask him about Venezuela more recently. I want to ask him what the prospects of socialism truly coming into force in Venezuela is, given the hegemony of capitalism. Please stay with us. Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. The program's associate producer is Jen Angel. I'm C.S. Song, and on our website, againstthegrain.org, you will find a link to a fairly new book by Monthly Review Press. It's entitled Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century. We have its author, Michael Leibowitz, by phone with us today from Vancouver. Very happy to have us here. Have him here with us. He's Professor Emeritus of Economics at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. The organized working class, when we think of workers getting together and organizing and coming together in trade unions, we sometimes think about the Marxist revolutionary class, right? The workers unite and they'll come together. They'll be the focal point of revolutionary activity. Of course, in some other societies, peasants, people in agriculture were considered to be the main revolutionary force. And of course, variations around the world. But to what extent has the organized working class in Venezuela been a key actor in this Bolivarian revolution in Venezuela?
Well, as the organized working class, it has not been a key actor. But, you know, there are a number of reasons for that. One reason is that the organized working class is only a small portion of the working class as a whole within Venezuela. That reflects the hollowing out of the economy. So there's only, you know, within the capitalist sector as such, there is, you know, there is not that much organization. There are a number of smaller firms which aren't organized at all, in which there's has always been very significant repression of attempts to organize. So you have a relatively small capitalist sector organized, and you have the state sector organized, and then I would say that roughly 50% of the working class in Venezuela is in what is called the informal sector. When you have that situation, you have to recognize that, you know, you have to organize the working class in many different ways. Now, let me just add, you know, another reason why the working class, the organized working class, has not been a major factor. The organized working class before Chavez and into the early Chavez period was, in fact, very closely linked to the Social Democratic Party that had been in power, the Acción Democrática, the ADECOs. And so it was part of the clientelism, you know, process. So that was called the Venezuelan Confederation of Labor, CTV. Now, there was a breakaway from that of workers and unions, which rejected the, you know, the complicity of the CTV in the coup and in the subsequent bosses' lockout in 2003, and they created something called UNITE, Unified Trade Union Movement, which was the Chavez Trade Union or federation, which has become the basic dominant organization of trade unionists now. But it's absolutely split between factions, and the factions have engaged in just enormous, you know, battling with each other over, you know, positions, over, you know, clientelism runs, you know, is healthy there too. And so you get a situation in which the internal warfare within the trade union movement, the Chavez trade union movement, has largely prevented it from performing the classic role as an organizing center for the working class.
So then who does Hugo Chavez see as the revolutionizing, the revolutionary force behind what he wants, which is a new socialism?
Well, Chavez looks to the majority of the working class, which is, you know, not simply those in the organized trade unions. He constantly says to the organized trade unions, you have to struggle not only for higher wages, you have to take your leadership role, you know, in this struggle to create a new society. But when Chavez, you know, therefore talks to, you know, people, he's talking to the mass of the poor, which is to say the mass of people who are largely in the informal sector. And so the question is, well, how do you organize, you know, that mass? Is it, you know, a completely sort of amorphous, you know, atomistic group of people? No, people live in communities. They live in communities of the poor. They have common interests. They see their links, you know. And so one of the unique characteristics that has emerged since 2006 has been, well, I mean, they were there in many ways before, but since 2006, there's been great attention to what is called the communal councils, legal creation of communal councils. Now, there were always, within communities, a lot of forms of organization. For example, land committees, since so much of the land was without title, it would have been occupied land in the cities, land committees, defense committees, health committees, which were organized around the barrio dentro, the doctors in the neighborhoods, larger than almost all of them Cuban doctors. All these have been little forms of organization in different communities. The concept of the communal council was to bring all these separate, distinct forms of organization together in councils that would deal with the problems of the community as a whole. So the communal councils are based on, in the urban areas, 200 to 400 families. That's basically 1,000 people who organize in the form of a local assemblies and also select, councils of spokespersons, voceros, who will carry forward and argue and organize for them. And this is, a small group of people who are engaged in identifying the problems of their communities, identifying ways to solve those problems. And in fact, what has happened in this last year, since January, is that Chavez has stressed, he's identified what he calls five motors of building socialism. And the fifth motor, and which is clearly the key motor in this process, well, they're all pretty key, but this is one of the most important, in terms of transforming the society, is the communal councils. The fifth motor is the explosion of communal power. And this idea that the communal councils, which are organizing locally, will not, and bringing together the local people, will not simply deal with their own communities, that they have to link up with other communal councils. That's always been implicit because many problems can't be solved by a group of 200 to 400 families, but they also have to take on and think about and begin to develop ideas about the society as a whole. Chavez has said in a line very reminiscent, of the Soviet, revolution, all power to the communal councils. In other words, the idea is that the communal councils will be the cell of a new state, a state built from below. And that is an absolute, critical aspect. So when you talk about what is the mechanism for change here, it is by stressing the development of a revolutionary democracy from below, which brings together the mass of the population in communal councils. Now, added to the communal councils will be the development of workers' councils within the individual firms, in the individual state sectors, and the development of links between workers' councils and communal councils in their areas, between cooperatives and cooperative councils of cooperatives and the communal councils in their areas, all with this focus on increasingly shifting over to producing for people's needs, increasingly shifting over to a process in which through their protagonism, people develop all their capacities, both individual and collective.
So is the basic idea that the communal councils identify community needs and then the worker-managed firms go ahead and try and satisfy those needs?
That is one of the conceptions. It hasn't been realized yet. I mean, right now we're still in the process of developing all those communal councils. There are, the last I heard, about 18,000 of them in the country. They expect that they'll get to around 25,000. In a number of cases where some of the communal councils are well advanced, they are, in fact, sitting down and talking to the cooperatives. In one of the areas, for example, in the state of Merida, electrical distribution firm Cadela, is working directly with the communal councils, it is one of those co-managed state sectors in which workers' committees are very much involved in Cadela. They are working extremely closely with the local communal councils, and this is happening in a number of different places. It's hard to know how many places it's happening because nobody sort of puts out a public announcement saying we are working this way and such like. But it's a process that's occurring. It's a very exciting process spontaneously, because if you are a community and you identify local needs, and if there are cooperatives producing in your area and if there are state sectors in those areas, it's logical to go to them and say, what can you do to help?
Mm. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm C.S. Song. He is Michael Leibowitz. The book is Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century. He joins us by phone from Vancouver, although he lives most of the year in Caracas, Venezuela, where he's trying to do what he can to support the Bolivarian Revolution, which he sees as containing the seeds of a new humanist socialism. If I can read a little bit from Michael's book, Build It Now, democratic decision-making within the workplace instead of capitalist direction and supervision, democratic direction by the community of the goals of activity in place of direction by capitalists, production for the purpose of satisfying needs rather than for the purpose of exchange, common ownership of the means of production rather than private or group ownership, a democratic, participatory, and protagonistic form of governance rather than a state above, over and above society, solidarity based upon recognition of our common humanity rather than self-orientation, and the focus upon development of human potential rather than upon the production of things. All these are the limbs of a new organic system, the truly human society. To which one must ask, which you do in this book, how likely is the emergence of such a society given the hegemony of capitalism, given intense capitalist competition between and among nations, and given the imperialist designs of the U.S.?
Not easy.
In two words.
That's the point. It's first of all, U.S. imperialism is the first, problem that one always has to be conscious of there. U.S. has, was behind and supported the coup in 2002. It supported the boss's lockout, and the CIA was involved in playing games with the computer systems at the oil company. It's supporting up to this present day. It's still financing through the National Endowment for Democracy, financing much subversion. And there is constant, threat of assassination. Whenever you hear, but you may not hear about it much because what you hear mainly in through the media in the United States is the horrors of Venezuela, the Hugo Chavez, the madman, et cetera, like that. The most incredible distortion of the press, which is matched only by the press, which the dominant press in Venezuela itself, which makes Fox look, like a far out liberal. Mm. That's what you don't hear about is all the cases where Chavez cancels meetings, when he doesn't show up when something has been planned, it doesn't. Why do they do that? Well, they do that because there's a security alert that they have discovered another plot for assassination. I mean, it's incredible. You have to understand that is the situation in which they're trying to build this new society. That problem, plus the problem of the domestic capitalists who are still entrenched in banking, in the processing sectors, the media. For certain, that's another problem. But you also have to recognize that, again, a culture of corruption and clientelism infects, the Chavez themselves. There are many Chavez supporters, leaders who say it's gone far enough. It's time to get off, and don't want this process to proceed. I used to say to people, look, Venezuela, there's a parasite looking for a new host. The host is there, and this is why Chavez's, insistence on creating new mechanisms from below, and one of those new mechanisms is the creation of a party, a new party built from below, which has not only the process, brings with it not only a process of creating new democratic structures from below, but also disposes of these clientelistic parties that had been behind his election in the past. So that's another factor. It's not only the external enemy, and the external enemy is there, it's also the internal enemy. I've suggested both in this article, that the book, and also in an article that will be in Monthly Review in the July-August issue, which talks quite a bit about Venezuela, the whole issue, but mine as well, that, there is this, this is one of the principal, problems, the necessity to recognize, to struggle against that emerging what's called the bully bourgeoisie or emerging new Chavez oligarchy, and that there is, very clearly a contradiction between the interests of some of those people in the leadership and the masses of people. And, hopefully, the process of creating the new party, the process giving, all power to the communal councils, strengthen those below, and create this situation in which they are increasingly not the objects, but the subjects of power.
2 minutes left. Why do you write that the Bolivarian Revolution has brought back the Marxism, specifically of Che Guevara, the great Cuban revolutionary?
Well, the short story is Che understood that you had to create new socialist human beings. He understood that it was not simply a question of developing productive forces, that you had to emphasize this idea of the importance of the new consciousness, and that is at the core of what is attempted in Venezuela.
Michael Leibowitz, he is author of Beyond Capital, Marx's Political Economy of the Working Class, and he's author most recently of Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century. We have time, Michael, for one more quick question.
Okay.
And maybe the one way to end would be, you write that Chavez, or you told me that Chavez has proposed to do something with the Constitution in relation to private initiative. Quickly, what is that?
Well, the Constitution, I don't have it right in front of me, but the constitutional change that he mentioned 2 or 3 days ago was to remove this section, which talks about the state's responsibility and obligation to support private initiative, et cetera, and would substitute for this a section which talks about the state creating the basis for a socialist society in which cooperation solidarity and development into full human potential, et cetera, are the core issues. So it's creating, building directly into the Constitution this idea of that subversive element that was always present in the Constitution, but now articulating it. And one of the things that I should mention is a key element that when you started off mentioning Chavez's speech in 2005, where he said we have to reinvent socialism and we have to, it has to be this new humanist social, etc. Now, in fact, Chavez had been talking about that for 2 years at the, talking about it, but he had been using the term the social economy. Now, in 2005, in January 2005, he said he renamed the social economy to talk about, we're talking socialism. And that's the same thing that's happening in the Constitution, this idea of moving from simply talking about human development to say we're talking about building a socialist society.
Michael Leibowitz, we have a link on againstthegrain.org to his new book, Build It Now, Socialism for the 21st Century. Thanks so much, Michael, for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I hope it helps to understand what's happening.
Absolutely. Thank you. And tomorrow on Against the Grain, we'll look at how abortion is being portrayed in film and the status of abortion rights today. That's tomorrow on Against the Grain, noon to 1. This is Sia, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And Jen and I will look for you tomorrow.
Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Sung with associate producer Jen Angel. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you can download audio and find links to show-related resources. We welcome your comments and suggestions by email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org, or you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670.